what I have been saying, I would like to reiterate an important point. As you might remember, we had spoken earlier of what Sri Aurobindo had said about the resurgence of the barbarian in ourselves. And it is this resurgence which causes the impact. Now in that context, Sri Aurobindo has made a further statement, a qualifying statement. And if that qualifying statement remains unchallenged or unchanged, then the peril is very great and there might even be a failure of human species as a human species. And I would like to draw attention to that qualification that Sri Aurobindo has made, and I would like to elaborate upon it. This is on page number 1052. And I shall repeat a few sentences which I had already read out to you earlier. And Sri Aurobindo says, the first danger is a resurgence of the old vital and material primitive barbarian in a civilized form. The means science has put at our disposal eliminates the peril of the subversion and destruction of an effete civilization by stronger primitive people. But it is the resurgence of the barbarian in ourselves, in civilized man, that is the peril, and this we see all around us. Now it is at this point Sri Aurobindo makes a very important statement. For that is bound to come if there is no high and strenuous mental and moral ideal controlling and uplifting the vital and physical man in us, and no spiritual ideal liberating him from himself into his inner being. Now this is the important qualification. In the first place, it is a fact that today there is no high and strenuous mental and moral ideal controlling and uplifting the vital and physical man in us. Secondly, there is no spiritual ideal liberating him from himself into his inner being. If you look at humanity at large, these two things are not at all to be seen prominently or to the degree to which they ought to be. And if this situation continues, then the peril is very great and all the other consequences of the failure of human species would follow. I would like to dwell upon this particular point. And I would like to say this is the impasse. The impasse arises from the fact that there is no high and strenuous mental and moral ideal controlling and uplifting the vital and physical man in us, and no spiritual ideal liberating him from himself into his inner being. Fortunately, I'm anticipating the argument, particularly because we were told about Orwell. The development of Orwell and the ideal which lies behind Orwell precisely attacks this particular point of impasse. Orwell proposes to put before us a spiritual ideal liberating man from himself into his inner being. If you read the charter of Orwell, if you read some of the statements regarding what Mother has said, what an Aurobindian ought to be, where Mother has laid down fundamentally that the Aurobindian lives an inner life. The fundamental proposition of a person who lives in Aurobind, that he lives an inner life. And one can live an inner life only if there is a spiritual ideal which liberates the man from his outer being and leads him to lead an inner life. This has happened. And this is why we can say that Sri Aurobindo, the Mother, have worked out so as to propose to the mankind so powerfully that a township is being proposed where people who can be inspired by the spiritual ideal can come together, live together and lead, first of all, an inner life. And secondly, this Aurobindo also implies a liberation of the mind in such a way that a mental and moral ideal begins to spread throughout the humanity. And this is an aspect which is not sufficiently understood by people in Aurobindo themselves, but it is implied that the very existence of Aurobindo implies a kind of an attraction given to the mental and moral capacities of human beings. The capacities which can control and uplift the vital and physical man in us. So since you had asked this question about Aurobindo, I would say this. The relevance of Aurobindo is central to the whole planning of the work that is envisaged before us. But I would still like to dwell upon this question of the impasse which has been created by the action of the mental and moral ideal. And we have to realize this fact. At large, in humanity, there is at present a kind of a weakening or even conspicuous action of the mental and moral ideas which can control and uplift the vital and physical man. This is the thesis that I would like to develop, if possible today, and may continue later on if there is no time today. But I would like to dwell upon this, and we must understand this quite well. And in this context, therefore, I would like, first of all, to speak of what is rationality, because what is mental ideal? Mental ideal is the ideal of the rational consciousness. And what is moral ideal? And what is ethical sense in man? And how these two important powers of humanity today, at the end of a cycle of the development of the reason, where they stand. And for that purpose, I would like to reflect on this question and share with you my reflection. As far as the mental ideal is concerned, as everyone knows, it is the Greek civilization which has given to the modern world, at least, a tremendous push towards the mental ideal. The Greek civilization itself may be regarded as a civilization of the human mind, as distinguished from the Indian civilization, which may be called the civilization of the spirit. Not that in the West there was no spirituality and there was no spiritual guiding light. But the fact is that that spiritual light has remained dim under the overpowering influence of the Greek civilization, which became highly mental in due course of time. At the same time, it is not true that Indian civilization was not mental. There is no intellectuality, on the contrary. But the fact remains that Vedic civilization developed the intuitive powers of consciousness, spiritual powers of consciousness to a very high degree. And when there was a danger of that high achievement being lost, a very remarkable phenomenon arose in Indian history, and that was the development of the Upanishadic age. As Sri Aurobindo says, that if you compare the history of India and the history of Greece, whereas in the beginning of Greek civilization, there was a powerful spiritual movement, greatly illustrated by the Orphic tradition, Eleusinian tradition. And in India, there was a Vedic development. The two were parallel. But whereas in the West, in the Greek civilization, following the Orphic elements, when that began to become dim, there arose a kind of an evening of spiritual light. And to my mind, Socrates and Plato represent the splendid colors of the evening light, where reason began to preponderate and the spiritual light was thrown into the background. In India, however, when the Vedic light began to be dim, and it did become very dim in the period of Brahmanas, but in the period of Aranyakas, once again there was a new stir, and in the Upanishads we get a brightness of that stir and a reassertion of the light that was available to India in the Vedic period. And therefore, in a more clear language, the Vedic civilization's truths were reasserted. And therefore, Upanishads became the foundation of the next cycle of development. Therefore, intellectuality did come, as in the West. Here also, intellectual age did come, but not immediately after the Vedic age. The Vedic age was followed by ritualistic age, which was followed once again by the spiritual age. And then came the development of the intellectual age. This is what makes a tremendous difference between the cycles of the West and the cycles of the East. This will also show us, when Sri Aurobindo says, basically, there is no opposition between East and West. If you read the message of Sri Aurobindo given to America in 1949, Sri Aurobindo speaks. He says that while I give this message to America, my message will equally be applied to India and to the East as well. And he also points out there is no such great division between East and West. But the difference has arisen only because of this emphasis which came to be laid upon the rational element in the Western civilization, and the emphasis on the spirit that was laid in the Indian civilization. Now, I am referring to this because I would like to mark out much more clearly how rationality developed in the West and in the East. And this will give us, if you trace out very quickly the whole history, we shall see where we are standing and what exactly is the nerve where we are now arrested, both in the West as also in India and the whole world at large. Let me therefore begin with a very remarkable philosopher in the early Greek period, namely Parmenides. Not many people are aware of Parmenides, but I would like that something of Parmenides is underlined by those of us who would like to study the history of rationality in the West. I have before me a book in which a very short sentence is given to Parmenides, which gives a precise formulation of the illustration of how rationality came to be articulated so sharply and so clearly in the following sentence of Parmenides. I am only stating this statement and I will not dwell upon it, although one can give 2-3 lectures on this sentence to analyze it. But I will not do it because I want to move rapidly through the history of rationality in the West and the East, just to show the impasse in which we are and how we can break it. Parmenides says, thou canst not know what is not, that is impossible, nor utter it, for it is the same thing that can be thought and that can be. Now, this is a very difficult sentence. It is very well articulated, and from my point of view, this statement has never been refuted in the whole history of thought, either in the East or in the West. Although many people believe that this proposition has been refuted or can be refuted. But this is my personal reading, and I would like to underline this one sentence, and I shall pass on further. In future, if you would like to be precise about the statement, I have read this particular statement from Bertrand Russell's History of Western Philosophy from page number 56, for those who want to see and read those two sentences, because that is the most important statement of rationality as it develops, the source of rationality as developed. I'll just read once again. Thou canst not know what is not, that is impossible, nor utter it, for it is the same thing that can be thought and that can be. Now, on account of this particular statement, Parmenides is able to assert that reality has got to be permanent and static, and that motion is impossible. This is the starting point of the Greek rationality, which therefore is throughout in the Western thought. To grasp rationally is to grasp that which is permanent, that which cannot be changed. Therefore, rationality came to mean, at least in the beginning, that which is rational, which cannot be altered, which is permanent. And the assertion of the permanent became the hallmark of philosophical thought. Now, this particular proposition came to be developed further, particularly through Socrates and Plato, and it opened up another dimension of rationality based upon this idea of Parmenides. But there was another dimension. And if you want to examine the structure of the argument, you will find from a simple example that Socrates himself says, if two things are similar, you must ask why they are similar. This is the structure of the argument. If two things are similar, if two cats are similar to each other, there must be a reason why they are similar. And the search for the explanation of the similar was the fundamental purpose of rationality. So this was also developed, that is to say, there must be something which remains the same in two things, which look similar. And that which is the same thing in two similar must be real. And you must refer to that reality to be able to understand all that is there in the world. It's the structure of the argument. It is on that basis that if you look more deeply, you will find in Plato his theory of forms, or the theory of ideas, or the theory of the universal. He came to the conclusion that the ultimate reality must be permanent, as in permanentism. It must be universal, and it must be the cause of all things which are moving in the world. We must remember that in permanentism there is no clue to understand the movement, because if a movement does not exist, cannot exist, it cannot be understood, does not exist. Plato, however, more synthetic in his approach, he had to deal with the problem of the movement, and he tried to accommodate the movement within the grasp of the permanence, which he described as that which remains the same, but which he also now described as the universal. And his whole concept of the good, which he regarded to be the reality, that good is universal. And it is that in which all things in the world can be subsumed. All the multiplicities, all things which look similar, there are types and types of people, types and types of things. All this can be generalized ultimately into the highest universal. And the highest universals are faith, the truth, beauty and goodness. And this we can further be subsumed under the highest good. And this highest good is ultimate reality. Now you can see how the rationality took a further step in Plato. Now this further step, however, has many deficiencies. And very importantly, Plato in his dialogue for Parmenides, is very significant. He examines his own theory critically through the mouth of Parmenides. And that is because the question of movement, which Plato thought has got to be subsumed under the idea of the good, surely he was not very sure whether it was really subsumed or could be explained. How to explain what may be called in Indian terms the being and the becoming, and how the two can be combined together, reconciled together, that was the problem which Plato could not resolve. And in his dialogue, Parmenides, the deficiencies of his theory are themselves criticized by Plato himself. He was aware of the deficiency. It is on that deficiency which was there in Plato that Aristotle went one step farther. And I will not go into Aristotle because that is another track altogether, but there is a slight deviation in the movement of rationality when you go from Plato to Aristotle. He also realized it was not possible to explain the synthesis of the being and the becoming. He tried it in his many ways, and the whole philosophy of Aristotle is nothing but his attempt to reconcile the being and the becoming. Ultimately, however, his fundamental contribution was to analyze the becoming. That is now a new shift which takes place in the Western thought. The idea of the being was to some extent put aside, and the greater emphasis was laid upon the phenomena of the becoming. And in Aristotle, we must know that Aristotle himself was the father of many sciences. And sciences are the studies of natural phenomena. And it is the science of becoming. But following the Parmenidesian tradition, Socratic tradition, Catholic tradition, we see in Aristotle explanation of the becoming strenuously tied up to the concept of the being. Not reconciled, but strenuously tied up with the idea of the being. And what is the form that it takes? And in that context, we must know what exactly Aristotle understood by the word rationality. In fact, we all know that it is Aristotle who gave us the first fundamentals of logic, which remained alive for 2000 years until what we call the modern logic, symbolic logic, came to be developed. But the theory of logic that he gave remained supreme throughout the whole history of Western thought, right up to the present day. Even now, Aristotelian logic is supposed to have been subsumed under the modern logic. It's not denied, but it is supposed to be subsumed. But what is important for our purpose is to realize that his enunciation of logic was a discovery of the inner structure of rational thought. And he pointed out that any human being who thinks rationally is guided by the inner structure. And what is that inner structure? And following the Platonic ideal, he said that the structure consists of relating the universal with the particular. Our experience of the world is the experience of particular. And these particulars can be rationally understood only when you discover a universe. And the structure of human reason is such that the particulars can be subsumed under the universe. He went one step farther in this discovery of the structure. That in this structure, it is to be remembered that in order that our thought is rational and therefore valid, there must be a strict adherence to what he called the concept of identity. And this is a very important concept of rationality. A proposition is undoubtedly true when the subject and the predicate are the same. A cat is a cat, nobody can doubt it. Or a tall cat is tall, nobody can doubt it. It is because of identity. An identity idea is arrived at from the idea of permanence. And the idea of universality. When universality and permanence, these two ideas are put together, then you get the real idea of identity. You can explain everything in the world rationally only if you ultimately reduce these things in terms of universality and identity. It is significant, therefore, that the three laws of thought which came to be formulated and which actually are the mark of rationality are the law of identity, the law of contradiction, and the law of experience middle. Now these three laws actually are nothing but restatement that a proposition is valid only if the predicate somehow can be shown to be identical with the subject. You can be sure of the proposition. Any knowledge can be sure of, can be rationally valid only if you can ultimately reduce whatever you want to say in terms of identity. There should be no contradiction. If there are contradictions, it is very invalid. And if you say that it's partly yes, partly no, that also will not be allowed. Either it is yes or no, there is excellent middle. When there are two propositions and they are in conflict with each other, only one can be true, the other must be false. If the two propositions are contradictory of each other. It is also significant, this is true of the deductive logic. When he came to define inductive logic, he made a very important discovery. That whenever we look at particulars in this world, there is a surprising phenomenon. And that phenomenon is that our mind gives a leap. Our rationality makes a leap. And what is the leap? Going from particular to universal. This is again return to Platonism. ultimate reality is the same, permanent, it is universal, and therefore in the thought also, when you see particulars, particulars cannot be understood properly, rationally, unless you make a link into universality. And therefore, inductive logic is nothing but rules and regulations which are to be observed in order to move from particulars to the universe. So, he came to see that all rational processes in the world are either deductive or inductive. If it is deductive, it is relating universal with the particular. If it is inductive, it is the particular relating to the universal. This became the hallmark of rational. It is nothing but discovery of the universal and the permanent in the flux of the plurality and multiplicity there in the world. But we must remember that this rationality was not able as yet to reconcile the particulars and the universal. It was not able to reconcile the becoming and the being. Now this failure of the Western rationality has remained throughout the history of it. Now, I omit at present the consideration of rationality as it came to be understood in the Middle Ages after Aristotle. And I come straight to Descartes because he is the rationalist of the modern time. And in Descartes, there is a restatement of Platonism and also the logic of Aristotle. There is no departure at all from the principles of universality and permanence and so on, except that there was a new attempt on the part of Descartes, and he underlined a new analysis of the human rationality. It is a fresh analysis. And this analysis started with the affirmation of doubt. Descartes is very famous for Cartesian doubt. In order to be rational, you must come to universal permanence. But if you simply assert it, it is not rational. You must arrive at it. You must be sure about it. You must have self-validation of this principle. And how do you do it? Therefore, he starts a process of doubting. And he says, you can doubt the whole world, you can doubt your mind, everything at all. Everything can be doubted. Until he came to the phenomena, I think. This is the one proposition which you cannot doubt because the very doubt itself implies thinking. So the instrument by which you doubt is itself an instrument which affirms what you are trying to doubt. And therefore, I think he said is incorrigible. It's a very important term, incorrigible. Intellectually, cannot be corrected. I think it's an incorrigible state. Of course, on the basis of this cogito, ergo sum, he developed the proof of the existence of God and also the existence of the self, of the soul. And it is very remarkable that his proof of the existence of God, if you examine properly, is nothing but the restatement of those two sentences of Parmenides. I will not dwell upon it. I leave it for further at any time. If you want to discuss it, we can discuss it. Very important. The argument that Descartes gave of the existence of God and proved the existence of God is nothing but proof of Parmenides, of the permanent being. This argument has been famous as ontological argument, which was restated by Spinoza. In fact, Spinoza receives a kind of a climax of Platonism, of the theory of Aristotle, of Descartes, and brings the whole rationalist system to a grand finale, you might say. In his Ethics, the way in which he has tried to demonstrate philosophy geometrically, so as to show that thinking can be absolutely logical and conclusive, in which no doubt remains at all. in which he once again reduces the whole universe to one permanent principle of the Absolute, which is universal and which transcends all limitations and which is one without the second. This proposition, he says, cannot be doubted by the human reason. Intellectuality in a certain sense came to be formulated most robustly by Spinoza. In the next step of the development, when we come to Leibniz, a remarkable change takes place. We must remember that Leibniz not only inherits Platonism and Cartesian philosophy, but he also inherits Christian philosophy. And this brings a new element into the whole perception. And this perception is very important. And for the sake of understanding rationality, this importance should be underlined. It is the following. In Christian theology, there is a distinction made between two states of becoming. And this is a very important distinction. There is, according to Christianity, the world as we see, understand it. And there is a heaven. Both have process of becoming. And yet, there is a divergence between that and this. Now, this perception of Christianity was not sufficiently amalgamated into rationality of the West until we come to Leibniz. You will see that in the Western thought, this distinction which is made by Christianity was in due course of time rejected. And even after Leibniz, who undertook to assimilate the Christian idea of the two kinds of becoming, this attempt which was made by Leibniz, even that came to be rejected in the subsequent development of rationality in the West. And therefore, whenever there is a discussion about rationality, there is an attempt to understand becoming as we find it today, but not in contrast to heaven. In the case of Leibniz, he clearly recognized the distinction between two kinds of becoming. The becoming as we see it now, and the becoming that is in the heaven. He does not use these two terms, which I'll come to shortly. But I just wanted to underline this distinction because it is of fundamental effect for an ultimate solution of the problem of rationality. One of the reasons why rationality has come to a kind of an arrestation today, it is because the distinction that has got to be made between various levels of becoming has been blurred. That is to say, our understanding of the world is not blind but one-eyed. It is only when you open both the eyes that you see both the world or many planes of the world. And our difficulty of rationality is that it tends to be a kind of an attempt to understand the world of becoming as we normally see it. And we don't suspect even that there is something else. Or if there is something else, we try to feel uncomfortable about it. But in Leibniz, and this is what I would like to point out, that logically, because Leibniz has been regarded as the greatest synthesizer in the history of Western philosophy. Bertrand Russell regards him to be the greatest intellect in the history of mankind. And as we all know, Russell himself wrote one full book only on lightning. And that is because of the importance of intellectual history as represented by lightning. Now, what was his fundamental contribution to rationality? He distinguished between two logics. He said that Aristotelian logic was only a logic of the law of contradiction, law of identity and actual middle. In other words, it was only the logic of identity basically. And therefore, that logic cannot explain very well the phenomena of the becoming. That logic cannot easily apply to the world of becoming. It can apply to the understanding of the permanence of the universal. But when you come to understand the phenomena and the becoming, we cannot give a full account, a true account of. Now, he spoke of these two logics as the logic of necessity and the logic of sufficient reason. And this is the special contribution that Leibniz made in the history of philosophy. According to him, the laws of thought which were enunciated by Aristotle are all laws of necessity. In other words, rationality consisted of showing that premises and conclusions, whether inductive or deductive, the relationship should be necessary. That is to say, if you start from a universal proposition, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, Socrates is mortal, you arrive from one proposition to the other, and the consequence will be necessarily true. If you start from the very proposition, conclusion must be necessarily true. Why necessarily true? Because it follows the law of identity. It follows the law of non-contradiction. It follows the law of actual middle. Therefore, the conclusion is necessarily true. In the inductive logic also, if you start with the particular and you arrive at a conclusion which is universal, the conclusion is a necessary consequence. And till the time of Leibniz, science claimed that its knowledge, whatever its knowledge, was based upon inductive process. An inductive process, you started with particular, arrived at universal, and all the universal laws gave you the knowledge of necessary consequences. Because of the law of gravitation, an object must fall necessarily from top to bottom. Because of that, the laws of tides of the ocean can be explained necessarily. The movement of planets can be explained necessarily. In other words, at that time, it was regarded as a scientific knowledge is also a knowledge of necessity. It explains all the necessary phenomena of the world. Now, Leibniz pointed out, however, that the world of becoming is not merely the world of necessity. There is also what we call the world of contingency. This is the discovery of Leibniz. And it emphasizes that this world is not merely the world of necessity. There is something like contingency. It may happen, may not happen. According to the law of necessity, it must rain today evening. If necessity is a ruling principle everywhere, you may not understand why rain must fall today. But if you knew all the facts of the world, if you knew the universal, if you know the permanence, If you know the connection of the permanent with the becoming, then you can be sure that it must be included. According to Leibniz, this is an assumption, not true. Bertrand Russell, while commenting upon Leibniz's theory, says, there was no necessity that Napoleon Bonaparte should have been born on 15th of August 1759. There was no necessity. He was born on 15th of August 1769. Why? There was no necessity. He was born. He happened to be born. It was contingent. So he said there is an element of contingency in this world. Now this is a proposition. This can be challenged. This can be discussed, debated. And in the field of rationality, this has been debated. But it is a very important underlining of the fact that the world does not consist merely of necessary events. It consists largely of contingency. But if contingency, the question was, does contingency imply chance? Has it happened by chance? Because contingency would be by chance he was born on that day. If it is chance, rationality goes off the board. There is no reason whatsoever why Napoleon should be born on that day. No necessity. But even contingency, is it by chance? And his answer was, it is not by chance either. Neither by necessity nor by chance. And he therefore gave a new dimension to understand the word rationally. So he said, when you cannot explain anything in terms of necessity, you should be able to explain a thing in terms of what he called sufficient reason. So he introduced in the logic, in the rationality, the presence of what is called sufficiency of reason, sufficient reason. And what is sufficient reason? And he explained, an event is contingent, but rational. If, first of all, it must be a possibility. If the world is chance, then even impossible things would happen. But that is not the case according to him. The world is world of contingency, but that contingency consists only of an event happening because it is possible. So first of all, an event must be possible. Rain must be a possibility. If it is not possibility at all, it will not happen. And secondly, there must be some special impulsion for it. And this is an important element in this rationality that he introduced in the Western world. It is very important. And what is that? According to him, this world cannot be explained, if there is not somebody who is controlling the events happening in the world. It doesn't happen by chance. First of all, there must be a possibility of an event to happen. But even if it is possible, it does not necessarily happen. Then why does it happen? What is the sufficient reason? So he says that there must be a controlling agency through whose will an event must occur. And if it is contingent, that will must be such that it can choose one or the other to happen. And it must be such, it must be omnipotent, so that nobody else disturbs it. therefore an omnipotent God capable of controlling many possibilities and freely deciding, this is the important idea, freely deciding an event to happen, therefore that happens, that happens. So an event in the becoming, in the whole world that you see, an event occurs because it is possible, and secondly because it expresses the free determination of God who allows that possibility to come into being. He went one step farther and he pointed out that this possibility is never alone in the world. God is not so limited that he has only a few possibilities that are, he has infinite possibilities. Therefore, he does not decide only one possibility to come into being. He decides realm of possibilities to come on the earth, to be manifested. Which realm? Because there are hundreds and hundreds of possibilities. So he says there are many possible ways in which possibilities can be combined. For this particular world in which we are living, there is a law of compossibility. It's a new concept he introduced in logic. Compossibility. Not only possibility, but compossibility. Events are decided by God to come on the existence. Possibles can be brought into manifestation if they are compossible. X will occur in this world if X is compossible with A, B, C, D, E, F, G. As against Y, which if it comes to exist, it will be compossible only with A and B. So if Y is compossible only with A and B, it will not occur. God will choose such a compossibility where the largest number of possibilities can occur and they can all be established in a harmony. That is why he spoke of a law of what is called pre-established harmony. According to him, all that happens in the world happens because it is all harmonious. So, according to him, the mark of rationality is harmony. It's a very important insight that he has given. That a rational person, rationality consists not only in perceiving permanence, not only in perceiving universality, but also perceiving necessity and also because the existence of possibility and contingencies happening because they are possible, and they are possible because they are composable, and composable because they are harmonious. Therefore, the mark of rationality is to seek for harmony and to discover the harmony. To be rational is to discover the harmony. There is always a harmony according to the whole world is actually a harmony. Now, it is not a fact that he was able to explain the harem of Christianity and the world as we see it. And I cannot say he reconciled the two. I only wanted to speak about it because there was a kind of a reflection of Christian thought on him, and he had an insight which he got from Christian theology. That this world by itself cannot be explained. Unless you accept rationally the existence of God. Therefore he believed God, believed in God to be rational. And God, rational in the sense that it is He who harmonizes and allows events to occur because they are harmonious with each other. And therefore, rationality of man consists in discovering the harmony. Now, this insistence upon harmony and perception of harmony as a part of rationality was affirmed by Leibniz very powerfully. You will recall, I'm speaking in parenthesis, Sri Aurobindo says in the very first chapter, all problems of existence are essentially problems of harmony. It is one of the most fundamental rational propositions that Sri Aurobindo has made in the life. All problems of existence are essentially problems of harmony. Rationality is guided by seeking for harmony. Where there is no seeking of harmony, it is not rational. If you don't seek harmony, anything can happen in the world pell-mell. The world is pell-mell. It is not rational. Now, we have reached only the midpoint of the development of rationality as the development of ethics. We move forward and we find that thereafter there was a turn in the Western, a new development of thinking as to what is thinking and what is rational. And there developed theory of empiricism as opposed to rationality. In other words, the entire tradition of Plato came to be questioned. Now, this questioning was inherent actually in Aristotle. As we marked earlier, that Aristotle tried to combine the becoming and being, and he revolted against Plato because Plato was not able to reconcile being and becoming, and he thought that he could do so. And if you look at it impartially, he did not actually succeed in doing it. But the cleavage was there, and there was, as it were, a kind of a trend of trend which emphasized the being and universality and permanence on the one hand, and a movement which emphasized becoming. And although up till now there was some way of combining being and becoming, although in a very loose manner, in a haphazard manner, and the problem had remained unresolved, there was here and now a clear departure, which said that Plato and all its tradition was fundamentally not acceptable, it's not rational. It does not take into account sufficiently the world as we see it. The becoming is very much minimized, the importance of the becoming is very much minimized in the whole history of philosophy. Except Aristotle tried to give some place to it. And Leibniz, who gave place to it through his theory of compossibility. But neither Leibniz was able to reconcile being and becoming, nor was Aristotle capable of doing it. Therefore, instead of carrying the baggage of this problem all the time, a time came and said, we should not be blocked by this baggage of universality, baggage of permanence, and this law of necessity, and a new trend arose in which we say we should see the becoming as it is. Not in the context of permanent and universal, but we should see the world becoming, the world of becoming, as it is. And how do we know the world of becoming? By experience. It is not by the help of the idea of universals and permanence and all that, of which Plato and others have spoken. We see the world as it is by experience. Now, this emphasis on knowledge of by experience an ideation or rationality which follows the logic of the becoming became now a more prominent feature. And that movement is right up till now continuing. Empiricism ultimately came to a climax in Hume. And Hume pointed out that experience is the only means of knowledge, and we have no experience in the world except sense experience. In the sense experience, there is no perception of universality, no perception of permanence, no perception of causality, no perception of explanation, no explanation. The whole world is simply what it is, and take account of the world as it is. And rationality consists in doubting any proposition which speaks of certainty of knowledge, which speaks of universality of knowledge, absoluteness of knowledge. Confine yourself only what you can know probably. And therefore, he is regarded as a skeptic. So, skepticism became the hallmark of rationalism. Becoming has to be understood directly, and this becoming can be understood with no other standard except in doubting. You can make even the laws of induction were, according to him, not sustainable. Even the laws of science, he said, even scientific knowledge can be questioned. So rationality came to consist in criticality and skepticism. So this is another mark of rationality which came to be underlined in the Western. It seemed as if with the arrival of Hume, rationality came to conclude that nothing can be known. And to assert that nothing can be known is a rational proposition. And no other rational proposition at all. This created a great crisis in the Western history of rationality. Is it really true that scientific laws which seem to give necessities is not valid? Is it not a fact that the things can fall and must fall directly? We do know. But if experience is the means of knowledge, only means of knowledge, you can only say, I see things falling. Do you see they must fall? In experience, you don't see they must fall. They are falling, but you do not see the must. Necessity is never seen. That the sun will rise tomorrow is expectation. And maybe it does rise tomorrow. But there is no necessity it must rise, may not rise tomorrow. As Hume says, I come out of my room and go away, and my room is on the hill, nobody perceives it at all. How am I to be sure that this room does not disappear when I go out of the room? It is true, when I come back, it is there. It is quite possible that it is always there when I see it. But there is no necessity that the house must be continuing to exist. Now, many of these propositions, many people laugh at, but actually they are very serious propositions. And it is because of the seriousness that Kant said he himself was awakened from his dogmatic slumber by Hume. By reading Hume, he felt that he was having a dogmatic slumber. And Hume could challenge him so powerfully that he was awakened. And because he was awakened, he felt the necessity of reformulating the whole rational fabric of human mind. Try to understand it. And that's why he wrote the famous book called The Critic of Pure Reason. And that is the whole theory of reason as he defined it. It's extremely important. He said that our human rationality consists of four complexes, four boxes, if I say, four spectacles, and two additional spectacles. Four equals four categories, and two equals two intuitions. They are automatic in your human mind. Rationality consists of putting everything in space and time. It is inevitable that whatever you see in the becoming, you cannot but see it in the context of space and time. This you can be absolutely sure. Why? Because your structure of reason is such, your human mind is such, and you cannot transcend human structure. It is there, it's your structure of the brain. Nobody can change it. It is there, pressing upon you. So you must see space and time. And everything is in space and time. And there are four categories. Everything in the world can be summarized into four forms. Quantity, quality, relation, modality. There is nothing in human knowledge which can transcend these four forms. One and many and plenty. There is no other quality, positive, negative and neutral. Relation, causality, etc., etc. Modality, maybe, may not be, is, and will not be. These are the only modes of your existence. There is no other proposition excepting 12 propositions that you can make, and all in space and time. So, 12 forms of propositions. For under 4 categories, each one can make 3 propositions. So, rationality consists in finding every proposition in this form. Well, one of the forms of proposition is, if it is fitted in, it is rational, provided it is put in the context of space and time. But this is all what we call phenomena. And this is what we call phenomenal reality. But he saw that phenomena themselves, to the important point, rationally, phenomena rationally takes you to that which is beyond phenomena. He perceived that if you are rational, you have got to affirm that phenomena by themselves are only structures. There must be a reality behind it. Behind the phenomenon, which we call noumenal. Phenomenal is what we see around, and it's a noumenal. Therefore, rationality consists in analyzing all the phenomena under 12 propositions, provided they are in the form of space and time. But leaving this proposition at the same time, that all these ultimately must be grounded in what we call the transcendental. He said, transcendental is not merely a possibility, it's a necessity of thought. To be rational is to be absolutely certain there must be a transcendence. In a sense, we might say, was reaffirming Plato and the whole rationalistic movement. But again, he said, what is that noumenal? As long as we have got this reason, we can never know, because you cannot transcend the structure. Whatever we see, whatever we know, will be only in this form. Therefore, we can only be sure that there must be a ground, there must be a transcendental, but transcendental cannot be known. Therefore, his philosophy is called agnosticism, not skepticism, because he is sure that there is a ground, but he says it cannot be known, therefore it is agnostic. You cannot know. You are sure it cannot be known. So rationality consisted in admission of agnosticism regarding the transcendental and framing everything that we see in the world under this 12 proposition. But he added one important. And that brings now the concern for moral ideas. Up till now, I have only spoken of the mental ideal, but now is introduced the moral idea. And a rationality which is concerned with the space, with the establishment of the moral idea. Not that moral ideal was not discussed in the earlier systems of philosophy. It was, and I did not touch upon it because it is not so prominently taken in the form in which we find in Kant. The rationality of morality is best illustrated in the philosophy of Kant, in his description of what is this. He pointed out that in this world of phenomena that we experience, there is one experience which is extraordinary. All the phenomena that you experience, they either exist or they do not exist, or they may not exist. But there is one experience which is very difficult. An experience which says something ought to exist. This is his digging out of the totality of human experience. That all human experiences basically are regarding things that exist. Those do not exist, they may exist, they do not exist. But this does not exhaust all that we experience. There is something in which we say it ought to exist. This is an experience to say it is undeniable. How do we account for it? What is the rationality of it? The rationality of it is that there is a human description of ought. Is there any human being who does not understand ought? Human rationality is such. It is at one time or the other obliged to speak of ought. In the Life Divine, Sri Aurobindo makes a very important statement. It says in the chapter on the light of existence. The sense in human being that you ought not to do what you do not want another to do unto you. If then you ought not to do what you do not want another to do unto you. If somebody laughs at you, you feel you should not laugh at them. You should not, obviously. Where do you get this proposition? This is the beginning of what is called ethical sense. It is inherently human conscience. If you don't take into account, you are not taking into account all the phenomena of the world. It's a phenomenon. This is very important. And you must explain from where this comes. Rationality consists in taking into account a phenomenon and trying to understand it, to explain it. That ought, he said, can be explained only if you can follow the ought. That is to say, ought implies can. When I say you ought to do, I can say you ought to do only if I believe that you can do it. You tell a child, you ought to be able to give a lecture tomorrow. You will not tell because the child is not capable of giving a lecture tomorrow. But when you say you ought to do it, you should tell a young son of 25 years and say, now you must You have got good muscles, you must run, sprint. You ought to do very well tomorrow. Ought to do, because you can. So he said that ought implies can. Now this logicality, connection between ought and can, was an important step in the rational development of Western thought. The discovery that rationality consists in discovering can from ought was a great discovery of Kant. And what is the meaning of can? If you analyze the meaning of can, means that you can choose to do this. And choose to do it freely. So he said, the can implies a free choice. And therefore he says that rationality consists in affirming freedom. Freedom and rationality came to be combined together. To be rational is to be free. And to be free is to conceive something which is not here, but which ought to be. The possibility of eliminating what is here and creating something else is a very important rational proposition. So rationality also consists in arriving at propositions which involve free exercise of the will and creation of that which does not exist. It's a very interesting remark made by Peters. He's a positivist, but he has written a very good book on ethics and education. And while describing the philosophy of Kant, he says that Kant had observed during his time that French Revolution took place. And what is the speciality of French Revolution? Speciality was that there was monarchy existing. If the idea of ought was not present, they could not have conceived the possibility of eliminating monarchy. The French Revolution conceived the ideal of liberty, equality, and fraternity. They are not there. But these are ideals. And these three ideals came to be the ideals of rationality. It is very important that Sri Aurobindo in the human cycle and in the ideal of humanity is a tremendous place in these three ideals. These three ideals are the ideals of the reason. Because reason can conceive the ought, because ought implies can, because can implies free will, therefore freedom of exercise of freedom for the ideal, for the ought, is a rational proposition. Ethics is rational. And that was a great affirmation of Kant. Now, I don't want to delve so much upon, because I have taken a lot of time, but I will now rapidly go up to the end of this story. And I would only make a comment that Kant made two great discoveries in rationality. One was that the world as we see it can be rationally understood in terms of space and time and in the form of four categories. That rationality consists in affirming that there must be a noumenal reality, transcendental reality. And rationality consists in freedom of man, individual, and the possibility of realizing and bringing into the world something that does not exist but something that is ideal and can be realized. Therefore, proposition which asks you to do something ideal is rational. These are his permanent contributions. And I would like to underline, one of the greatest contributions he made was the discovery of the individual in the phenomenal world. The world of phenomena does not consist only of things, events and personalities. There is individualism. Why? Because freedom is experienced by the individual. Individual feels I ought to, even when the whole world may not be. I feel it is something that arises from the depth of the individual himself. Now, what is that individual? What is the centrality of the individual? I must say that he has not fully expounded or explained. Nor would I like to say that Kant has explained everything. I am only trying to say that the concept of rationality in the West at this time came to be formulated in this large, elaborate manner. Thereafter, after Kant, as I said last time, a period came. There was a possibility at this stage after Kant, post-Kantian philosophy could have taken a different direction. But by now, something has begun to develop. And it is that development that has led us to the present crisis. The development of rationality as it developed later on, after Kant, that is responsible for the present, what I call, the downward curve of the development of reason arriving at the present impasse. If the concept of freedom, if the concept of the individuality as understood by Kant, if the ideal of rationality and freedom and ideality were all developed further, perhaps the present impasse would not have come about. Perhaps. Because in this world of uncertainties, anything is possible. But what happened actually is, post-Kantian philosophy gave rise to four important developments. The empirical positivism, phenomenology, existentialism, pragmatism, and postmodernism. Phenomenology and existentialism are very similar, so I count it only as one major movement. In the sense that the empirical rationalism continued the human line of rationality. It rejected Kant, but derived from Kant some of the important propositions, like the importance of the individual. At the same time, following the Jungian lead, discarded concern for transcendental, for universality, and all concept of necessity. This is how rationality in logical empiricism came to. Not that it does not take into account what is some sense of universality or necessity, but they try to interpret this word in some other phenomenal manner, linguistically, but not fundamentally in any metaphysical, ontological manner. Phenomenology is a very interesting development. If I had the time, I would like to discuss at length the rationality as it was developed by Husserl in his phenomenology. But his main conclusion was that whether ultimate reality exists or not, whether the world exists or not physically. Rationally, you can at least temporarily suspend our belief in the existence of God or existence of the world. Why? Because we can be certain only of the phenomena of consciousness. And the indelible, indestructible structures of consciousness. And these indestructible structures of consciousness have three elements. The element of intentionality, the element of ego, and perception of the universal, in which ego finds its place. The assertion of these structures and discovery of the structures is a task of rational endeavor and understanding the world in terms of these three structures. There are many more details, and the whole terminology of yourself is a very difficult domain, and I do not want to enter into all that. Existentialism takes up this phenomenological emphasis on the ego, but it omits the phenomenological emphasis on the universal and underlines the importance of the individual. It's an analysis of the individual and the experience of the individual as the individual. The freedom of the individual, these are the important things which phenomenology of existentialism efforts. Pragmatism finds one criterion of the truth. A rational proposition is true and is rational if it produces the effect which is intended to be produced. Successful results of a proposition when applied is a mark of truth. A true proposition is a proposition which must succeed. If it is true, it must succeed. It must be useful, practicable, it must result in consequences which are intended. And rational proposition is a proposition which is pragmatically successful. Honesty is good because it pays. Religious belief, as William James, one of the greatest pragmatists, said, religious consciousness creates healthy mindedness. And healthy mindedness is very good. Therefore, whether God exists or not, it does not matter. If belief in God gives you health in your mind, you allow and nurture belief in God pragmatically. You can never decide whether there is God corresponding to religious consciousness or not. But you can know this much, that belief in God produces healthy-mindedness, therefore you may say that proposition must be true, because it's successful, creates healthy-mindedness. Or even if that proposition is not true, for practical purposes you should take it to be true. Now postmodernism combines all these movements of logical empiricism, of phenomenology and existentialism, and pragmatism. He adopts the proposition of language and the emphasis on language from logical empiricism. He takes the proposition of individual and the freedom of the individual from phenomenology and existentialism. He adopts the criterion of pragmatism and comes to the following conclusion. In fact, this is a subject on which I want to hear the Devashish today. And therefore, when I will speak of it, I only speak like a small child, because I am not such a so scholarly in respect of postmodernism. But whatever I understood, I can only tell you this, that postmodernism maintains that rationality consists in asserting that whatever is knowledge, whatever is true, should be expressible in language. There should be a text. All knowledge is something that can be derived in text, from text. Secondly, every individual, when he encounters a text, he encounters it as a free individual, and therefore he understands the text in which it is specially individualized himself. Therefore, his understanding of the text is something individual. And thirdly, insofar as he finds that what he understands is successful, it is true. The net result of this postmodernism is that there is no knowledge, affirmation of any knowledge which is not textual, not reducible to text. Secondly, that all textual knowledge can be interpreted, and this is the whole development of what is called hermeneutics. Hermeneutics is the science of interpretation. Everyone is free as an individual to interpret the text. The consequence is that there is no possibility of making any statement valid for all. There is no possibility of stating that any knowledge is certain. But every piece of knowledge is good for himself according to what he understands. But he should allow others also to believe that whatever is understood by him or by her is true for him and for her. Reason, according to postmodernism, cannot go beyond this. It cannot know what is ultimate reality, cannot know if there is any ultimate purpose in life or in aim. No utopia can be formed. The world is what it is, and every individual is free to understand this world through text in which knowledge, rational knowledge, is translatable. Now, on this basis, therefore, you cannot erect any moral ideal, no rational ideal. And you can find, actually speaking, that all the four movements which are today basically are incapable of giving any rational mental ideal or moral ideal. And if we are therefore to remain only there, it can go round and round, uncertainty, relativism, agnosticism, skepticism of various kinds, and freedom for every individual to do what he thinks is right. This is all that can be proposed. Therefore, there is no presence in the present scenario of any idea which can lift man. And what Sri Aurobindo says, therefore, becomes so meaningful. And I would like to repeat again, say, if there is no high and strenuous mental and moral ideal controlling and uplifting the vital and physical man in us, and no spiritual eye liberating him from himself into his inner being, and this is exactly what has happened, and that is all around us, then the only consequence will be economic life, perfection of material life, huge structure of the buildings of its structure, and the resurgence of barbarism in human civilized society. This is inevitable. This is the impasse, and this is where we stand today. And fortunately, however, I would like to end my statement by stating the following, what Sri Aurobindo said in the ideal of human unity. And there is a similar statement in the human cycle. and I shall only refer to these two statements and conclude for the present, because these two propositions give us what in Aurobindo's own terms, that humanity will not be arrested, and something else will happen. And that possibility is dependent upon the following. And I read on page number 555 of the volume number 15, where Sri Aurobindo says, "But the higher hope of humanity lies in the growing number of men who will realize this truth and seek to develop it in themselves, so that when the mind of man is ready to escape from its mechanical band, perhaps when it finds that its mechanical solutions are all temporary and disappointing, the truth of the spirit may step in and lead humanity to the path of its highest possible happiness and protection." And what is that higher truth which humanity can hope to realize? And that is what Sri Aurobindo states just on a paragraph above it. And he says that that truth is the truth of oneness. And I read it, a spiritual oneness which would create a psychological oneness not dependent upon any intellectual or outward uniformity, and compel a oneness of life not bound up with its mechanical means of unification, but ready always to enrich its center, its secure unity, by a free inner variation and a freely varied outer self-expression. This will be the basis for a higher type of human existence. And to connect it with the question of Aurobindo, I would say, this is what is proposed for Aurobindo. So I conclude here, but if there are any comments, I'll be happy to hear a few comments in the remaining time. Thank you.